and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Belling, and today we're taking the first of many dives into creating lifelike characters with a special guest, Abby, from the YouTube channel Political Psych with Abby. We're chatting all things psychology, what drives us, what makes us do the things we do, what makes us join groups and movements and activist things to do with that. We're also going to take a look at how to create suspense with our writing. And I've got one very simple device or tool that you can use that will pretty much have your readers hooked throughout the whole book. Before we get into some psychology, though, I'd be very, very grateful if you could please subscribe or follow the podcast. If you know of anyone you think may enjoy it, a share with them would be amazing too. And if you've got a few seconds to spare, a quick rating on Spotify, which is a new feature that you can do now to show how much you enjoy your favorite shows, or a review on iTunes or anything like that. Social media would be amazing. If you're looking to expand your learning beyond this podcast, why not check out our Patreon page? I've got exclusive writing classes on there. There's interviews, books, loads more, new stuff going up last week, this week, and in the next few weeks too. So do go ahead and head on over there to learn a bit more. Now, let's get on with the show, shall we? And first up, a look at all things psychology with political psychologist, Abby. Today, I am delighted to welcome a very special guest, political psychologist and YouTuber, Abby. How are you doing today, Abby?
I'm good. Just getting over COVID, so my voice is going to sound maybe a little weird. But other than that, I'm good.
Oh, that's good to hear. I'm not about the COVID, of course, but that you're on the mend, which is the most important thing. Abby has a YouTube channel, which is dedicated to all things political psychology. And it's called Political Psych with Abby. There are some fantastic videos on there, so please do go and check it out. You can find the link in the description. And you may be wondering why I've asked Abby to come on the show today to talk a bit about psychology and political psychology. And this all ties into how writers create characters. Now, there are lots of different methods of creating a character, but the one I think works the best is something called the bone structure. And this comprises exploring three dimensions of our characters: physiology, sociology, and psychology. And the product of the first two is psychology. So we're basically coming in at the end of the formula, and we're looking at the psychological makeup of our characters. And I think it's so important to have an understanding, especially if you're creating characters who are meant to be as alive as other people who exist in the real world. And we've got the added bonus of Abby coming from a political psychology background, because at the moment, politics impacts all of our lives, even if you wouldn't call yourself political. And if we're looking to tell fantasy stories that are relatable to the real world, which is something that I like to do, understanding these different strands of the bone structure is vital. And politics is rife with conflict, which is what we need for interesting stories. So, Abby, can you tell us then a bit about how our psychology, our psychological mindset, shapes who we are, what we believe, and what we do?
Well, something that I think a lot about in the political psychology context is personality, right? So that's an aspect of your psychology that's shaped by your genetics and by your life experiences. So that's a combination of nurture and nature, as basically everything of your psychology is. So yeah, I guess if you're writing a character, you want to know who their parents are, because yeah, that's a huge impact. Anyway, what I was going to say is, and so someone's personality is going to impact the way that they act a lot, and the values they care about, their morality, all that sort of thing. But it is super important to keep in mind that the situation someone finds themselves in has huge impacts on their behavior. There's actually a really interesting thing called the fundamental attribution error. And what that is the idea that people tend to attribute their own actions to situations and the actions of others to their personality or their nature, like whether or not they're a good or bad person, maybe a little bit too much. The example being, right, like, if you see someone else speeding, you might be like, oh, they suck, they're a bad person. But if you speed, you're like, well, I had somewhere really important to go. Yeah. There was no one else on the road, or that kind of thing, right? So I think that's a really interesting thing to keep in mind, just how much people are affected by their situations, right?
Yeah.
And I genuinely believe in good and like better and worse people. And there definitely are better and worse people. But the idea of sort of like absolutely good and absolutely evil people is perhaps not so true if you look at it psychologically. So that's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, I think this is something that I love exploring, like what is good, what is evil. And especially in the fantasy genre, it is that sort of that great debate between good and evil, isn't it? And I tend to think that we all reside within the gray. None of us are perfect, like you say. No one's a saint, no one's an absolute dark, a Sauron.
Exactly. Although I definitely, you know, don't take the stand that we're all, you know, as good or as bad, or, you know, that good and evil don't exist. I don't really have necessarily science for that. I just think that you end up in a bit of a mental mess if you don't believe in something.
I think I was chatting to my friend about this recently, about the need to have some kind of spirituality in your life, some sort of moral compass, like, that helps you decide what is right.
For me, it's not even really a spiritual thing. Like, I'm not really a very spiritual person, but I guess I believe in the goodness in people, right? Yeah. That's what gets you through a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of that does come from having studied psychology, which is that, I mean, the fact that we can do anything and the fact that we can care about each other and care for each other is kind of amazing. You know, I'm much more on the social psychology end of things. You know, I don't spend a lot of time with, let's say, the more biological aspect of the human mind, right? But yeah. I have, you know, in undergrad, I held a human brain in my hands, right? Ugh. And it's just this squishy mass, right? And the fact that has the capacity for, you know, all the good and amazing and beautiful things that humanity has done is kind of amazing and beautiful. And I guess that's sort of my part of my sort of moral core there. You know, there's something that makes people a certain way, right? I think that most people who do evil in the real world either think that they're doing good, or they think that they're acting in their own self-interest. I think that there are some people who just want to watch the world burn, but I don't think that those are as many people as perhaps portrayed in fantasy. And if there is someone like that, you know, they're likely to be, you know, not that it's an excuse for what they would do, but probably pretty mentally ill. You know, but I'm not the kind of psychologist who's an expert on mental illness, so I don't want to go into that too much. You know, my master's degree basically didn't really cover anything about mental illness because it's political psychology. So I basically only have the knowledge of something like mental illness of someone who has an undergrad degree in psychology. So I'm not an expert on that at all. And you should absolutely have someone with more clinical psychology background on to talk about that kind of thing.
Well, I think what's quite interesting, which a trend that I've noticed in the fantasy genre in recent years, is what you say, like that, by these villains who are just sort of evil for evil's sake. People are just fed up with that because there's no relatable human side to that. Like you say, there needs to be sort of the reason why people do things, or the reason why they believe certain things. And I think that's so much more interesting than just having an evil, all-powerful antagonist, who, like Sauron, for example, who's just trying to make the world burn, like you say.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's just so much more interesting, isn't it? And what I tend to find is that when we move to, like, looking at characters and their justifications, like, in an antagonist's mind, they are completely justified in what they're doing. They are right.
Yeah. The only thing that annoys me about the recent trend, and I would say that this is perhaps more in like superhero movies or something than like fantasy literature, is that there are certain very specific sort of good points or movements that are worthwhile that they'll assign like villains to. in ways that make very silly people devalue those movements, right?
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of, you know, making your villain, you know, an environmentalist who goes too far in a world like it's terrifying what's happening with climate change, right? And yeah. It's not really necessarily, you know, responsible in your fiction to demobilize people that way, right?
Yeah. So do you say there's any sort of key psychological factors that writers can sort of bear in mind when they're creating the characters if they want to make a character a certain way?
Even if you have a fair amount of training in psychology, I feel like the main way to be able to really understand a person is to meet that person and spend a lot of time with them, if you get what I'm saying. So yeah. What I would say to do is to think about what the character's life was like before the story, and especially at like a very early age, right? Like, you've probably experienced, you know, meeting someone and then like, you know, meeting their family or going to where they went to grow up, and you're like, oh, okay, you make sense now. So that's an important thing. But if you're looking for something a little bit more scientific, I would say to sort of try and figure out where they fall on like different personality variables, right? Like, a lot of people use the Myers-Briggs. It's not honestly super scientific. I mean, it's probably fine for like writing a fantasy novel, but it's not really used in like, you know, scientific experiments anymore. You know, so the a commonly used personality model now, I believe, is called the OCEAN model. So that stands for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And if you can understand sort of how high your character is on those traits, that's going to feed into a lot of other things about them and a lot of things about their politics as well. So we in political psychology, deal a lot with the OCEAN scale and also sometimes the Hexico scale, which is pretty similar to the OCEAN scale, except that it also includes the trait of honesty. Obviously, how honest your character is going to feed into things. But, you know, you're going to want to think about, you know, how open they are to new experiences. That's the openness thing. When you're thinking about, you know, how many times are they going to refuse the hero's journey or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you have someone who's, once they're there, if they're super eager and excitable to do everything, you probably don't want them to be like super hesitant to get started unless there's a reason for their personality to change, right?
Is there any like sort of, I'm trying to think, like you said, you mentioned like parents before. So the sort of role like your parents play in your life do have quite a significant impact, don't they, on what you become? How you respond to certain things in the world around you?
I mean, definitely, yes. I mean, some of the more nitty-gritty stuff is stuff that I'm really not an expert on, but absolutely. In psychology, we're always talking about, you know, nurture and nature, right? And nurture is a huge factor in basically everything, even things that are, you know, even the most genetic things usually have some aspect of nurture to them, right? Nurture is absolutely not just the parents, but especially things that are set early in life, the parents or the people who raise the child, right? Those could be, you know, grandparents or, you know, an orphanage or something, right? Are going to have a big impact. And they're going to have a big impact in, you know, how that character relates to and bonds with and trusts other characters, right? If a character had a really distant parent, really emotionally distant parent, they're probably going to respond in one of two ways, either by being sort of emotionally distant themselves or by being, for lack of a better word, a bit clingy. I mean, none of these things are ever going to be 100%, right? It's all correlate to each other, right? You can have people who, you know, grew up in a really difficult environment and turn out fine. Or people who grew up in a completely, you know, normal, healthy environment and have really serious issues, right?
Yeah.
But the environment does play a huge role. And also, you know, in what people want out of life, right? Yeah, no, I mean, so that's going to play a role.
That's very important, I suppose, in fiction, because when we look at what a character wants, that is their primary motivation in a fictional story. And often the story follows them trying to achieve that, isn't it? So
exactly, yeah. And that's where I'd probably bring in something like relative deprivation, which is that people really compare themselves to the people around them, right? And how much they feel like they have and how well they feel like they're doing is very dependent on how people around them are doing, right? Like, so if someone, you know, in a fantasy setting, right, if they come from like a very, you know, poor village and the wealthiest person in the village is just, you know, the person who has three pigs, right? Their quest might be that they just want three pigs. Whereas someone who comes from a background where they're, I don't know, let's say an aristocrat. I'm going with like very cliche fantasy here because very, very like basic fantasy, because I think that's probably the easiest to then translate more widely or for people to have a frame of reference. You know, if someone's from like a, you know, a very sort of aristocratic background, right? They're not necessarily going to be satisfied with the comfortable life with three pigs, right? They're going to maybe want to become, you know, a higher ranking aristocrat or even the king or something, because they're comparing themselves to that. They're comparing themselves to what they're around, right?
Yeah, of course. So I was going to ask you, you obviously specialize in political psychology, which for a writer, I think, is a really great source of inspiration because, as you know, politics is just full of conflict. So what can you tell us about this side? Because I understand that it relates to the psychology of like behind opinions, like groups, movements. So what can you tell us about this side of things?
Yeah, you gave a pretty good description, groups, movements, all that kind of thing. Basically, if it relates to politics, it can be political psychology, right? So it's really sort of a subfield of like social psychology, but with more of an emphasis on the political aspects of things. So in terms of how that would relate to, you know, writing and that sort of thing, a lot of, you know, books are going to have movements within them, right? You know, maybe your characters are, you know, fighting to free the kingdom or all that kind of thing, right? And there are a lot of ways that those movements exist in the real world. And so, you know, look, take inspiration from real movements, but it's important to keep certain things, right? Or not keep certain things. Like there's a social identity model of political movements that you can look up, and it's pretty useful. And I would suggest writers go to it. And it basically tells you, okay, like this is what causes people to form a movement. This is what they'll rally around. And then, you know, this is what they'll do then, right? And then there's even some aspects of that that feed into like, okay, will this movement, you know, escalate to violence, that kind of thing, right? Like, for example, the social identity model of movements makes you realize that, you know, people complain about identity politics constantly, but a lot of politics are identity politics, almost all politics, if you want to view it really broadly. If, you know, your characters are part of a movement or there is a movement within the world, it's useful for there to be sort of an identity that that movement exists around, right? And that can be, you know, a demographic identity, or it can be an identity of, you know, a common cause, a common vision for the future, a common worldview, that kind of thing, right? There has to be some agreement, some sense of cohesion, an idea of a group, right? And, you know, it's very unlikely that a group is, for example, going to be liberated by nothing but well-meaning outsiders to that group, right? So that's a very important thing to keep in mind. Also, what's really interesting is, especially, you know, more radical movements or more marginalized movements are often sort of categorized as random. In a way that they're typically not. Even if you look at like riots, which buildings get vandalized are typically targeted, you know, unless you have a horde of zombies, you probably want to put thought into, you know, what they're destroying, right, during a riot. Yeah.
A good example at the moment in this country, it's been all the news, where the Black Lives Matter movement in Bristol, a lot of protesters threw this statue of an old slave owner.
Yeah, I was. I think I was in the UK for that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well,
yeah. I only moved to the US like 6 months ago.
Oh, there you go then. But might know. But so they recently had the trial, like last week, I think. Four people, and it was a trial by jury, and the jury said that they weren't guilty, even though it was technically breaching the law. I agree with the jury, but it's really interesting, like, because that's what you say. It's like a movement, isn't it? It's like a riot. It seems quite, but it's like they were targeted, these statues, because of what they represented.
Exactly. Although, I mean, it's also important to realize that, you know, the violence of movements like Black Lives Matter and, you know, whatever, and, you know, probably also movements in whatever fantasy world you're writing is typically going to be exaggerated by people who are favoring maintenance of the status quo, right? You know, trying to make them seem scary, right? Like in your fantasy world, you shouldn't necessarily, you don't have to make the authorities, you know, completely trustworthy, and, you know, they will present information in a way that's going to, you know, further their cause and further their case. Everyone does that, right? One really important thing you have to learn in political psychology is that there is no such thing as unbiased, right? Like, I mean, you try to be as unbiased as possible when collecting, you know, scientific data, and that you can treat as, you know, roughly unbiased. But obviously, you know, with news sources or that sort of thing, you know, there's going to be more and less bias, right? But, you know, biases do come into things, even in just like how people see things, how people see the world, right? It's impossible to move beyond your biases completely, right? And, you know, there's stuff where people are actually better at arguing against positions they disagree with, right? And they're better at remembering information in favor of positions they agree with, right?
It is really interesting to see what motivates people to take action as well, like to go out and riot to that extreme. And it's these sorts of extremes that interest me the most.
I mean, people are motivated usually when they don't find, you know, people usually try a peaceful solution first, right? People are not like naturally super violent, right? So, you know, there are a lot of instances in which, you know, the authorities have avoided rioting by saying or doing the right thing, you know, in line with what peaceful protesters want, right? And a lot of the time, also, it is important to keep in mind, you know, in the context of riots in our world, a lot of them, you know, the police or whoever's enforcing, you know, order will do something aggressive to try and turn a peaceful protest into a riot so they can use force. And, you know, something like that is probably going to carry over to your fantasy world, right? But what I was going to say is it's also really important to keep in mind that people tend to get involved in these sort of mass movements, both more radical ones and less radical ones, when they find that they cannot advance on their own without a larger movement, right? Like, a lot of the time, you know, someone's not going to get, like, they might, you know, for example, they might label themselves a feminist, but they're not necessarily going to get involved in a lot of feminist activism or a lot of, you know, more countercultural or counter-system feminist activism if they believe that if they just keep their head down and do the right things, they're going to be able to, you know, solve all their problems as an individual, right? And not have to be part of this movement.
That's really interesting. I mean, I always chat to my girlfriend about the Me Too movement and how so many women took courage from that movement to come forward and say things that they would never have said without that movement. Like, say, it's they've been unable to do that alone.
Yeah, exactly. There's the power of community for you. Exactly. People tend to, you know, be empowered by each other and not necessarily, you know, do things alone. You know, what's really interesting is, you know, in the early history of social psychology, a lot of it is, you know, trying to explain, you know, this the so-called madness of the peasants, you know, during the French Revolution, but eventually look at it through, you know, a less biased lens of, you know, not, you know, being an upper class French person during the French Revolution, and you realize the peasants weren't mad, right? You know, people do sometimes go a little bit crazy in crowds, and this can happen, you know, in digital crowds as well, right? Not just physical crowds, but crowds can also be incredibly empowering in a really important way and sort of freeing for people, right? So the idea that, you know, the mob, the crowd is this evil is sort of false, if that makes sense. Yeah. By the way, on riots and crowds specifically, I'm drawing a lot on the work of a former professor of mine, Stephen Reicher. And he writes a lot of stuff that's like very publicly accessible. So if people want to look into that, he's a good person to start with.
Nice one. Yeah, sounds good. So I was trying to find some examples of political psychology, specifically in fantasy fiction. And there's not an awful lot, but I think the best one that I could find was in Game of Thrones, with the rise of the High Sparrow and the Faith of the Seven. So I don't know if you're familiar with Game of Thrones.
So I've seen the TV show, but I haven't read the books.
Yeah, well, I think it's quite, it's illustrated very well in the TV shows, I think.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen it, but I do think that that was portrayed reasonably well, right? Because you have this movement from below, and it's a religious movement, which historically a lot of these movements were, you know, and the religion is a good identity for people to rally around. You know, these are people who aren't going to be able to advance themselves individually, usually. They are really searching for something. They are sort of targeted in their way. And you can also believe that, you know, the leader of it, the High Sparrow, right, is someone who would be able to control a movement like that, because leaders, it's very important that they're sort of embodiments of the identity of their movements, if that makes sense, or the identity that their movement wants to have, right?
Yeah.
So if it's a movement that puts, you know, that views itself as very holy and very humble, it's very important that they have a leader who portrays himself as very humble and very holy. What's really interesting is, you know, coming from a background in social psychology, I really found myself rooting for Marjorie Tyrell in Game of Thrones. She's kind of the only one of them that like actually understands people a little bit. She really gets done badly. But although I guess you could argue that Daenerys understands people a little bit too, and she has an interesting movement going on there, although a little bit of a maybe a savior thing going on there. I'm not necessarily going to get into that much. I don't remember it that clearly. But what I was going to say is, you know, Marjorie, right, is sort of going among the people and distributing food and, you know, interacting with that movement in a less confrontational way. And that would be the way to fend off violence from sensible authorities. That would be the way to have order without having to be outwardly incredibly authoritarian.
Hey, babe, what you got there?
This is a check from Carvana. I just sold my car to them. I went online and Carvana gave me an offer right away. Then they just picked up the car and gave me this.
Well, that's a big check. Well, obviously you could put this towards your next car, or we could finally get that jacuzzi, or I could start taking tuba lessons, or I could quit my job and write my memoir.
Or I can put it towards my next car with Carvana.
Sorry, your check, not mine.
Sell your car to Carvana. Visit Carvana.com or download the app to get a real offer in seconds.
Right? So she's the one who's being smart about it. But, you know, most of the other aristocratic characters on the show are just like, oh, no, 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 this movement is bad. It's evil, right? We just got to, you know, crack down on it, right? So it's a very different approach. But, you know, if they had all been acting like Marjorie, it would have turned out very differently.
Yeah. It's amazing, really. It's so brilliantly done, Game of Thrones, like written in particular. And if you look at like little incidents like that where you can see that there's an issue like with the people that they haven't got enough food. So
yeah,
she comes in, curries favour with the people by distributing food. But the fact that in contrast, Cersei doesn't do that. And that, in effect, creates the circumstances in which someone like the High Sparrow can rise up.
Yeah, it's also, I think, very important to pay attention to things like food in fantasy books, and that's something, and in fantasy works, and that's something that Game of Thrones does very well. You know, people, we're not that complicated, right? Like, we want to eat, we want to have a comfortable place to sleep, we kind of want to not, like, we want to not die of disease, right? We want our families to be safe, right? Like, so a lot of movements are going to be around that sort of thing, right? And a lot of them are going to relate to other identities, but those are usually identities that are disadvantaged in one of those realms, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I think it's very important to, like, pay attention to sort of, like, you know, the material needs of people in the fantasy story and people trying to get, you know, what they need, because a lot of psychology is about that, right? Like, you're not really going to have a lot of conflicts that are completely about, you know, philosophy with no material basis, right? Like, there's going to be, you know, high-minded philosophical, you know, stuff that people will use to try and justify things. But a lot of the time, right, it is going to be about people need to eat, right?
Yeah.
So that is something that I thought, you know, Game of Thrones did really well. Also, I believe that Game of Thrones, a lot of it is drawn from historical examples.
Yeah.
And I definitely would encourage people to draw from historical examples in writing, you know, fantasy, even if it's supposed to be set in, like, the far future or something. Because the truth is, like, other than environment, human brains have, like, we've changed some. And there is a lot of variance across cultures. But people are people, right? And so, you know, there is going to be a lot of, you know, similar behavior to in the past. But it is important, I think, to keep in mind that, like, you know, different cultures and things are going to have, you know, different customs, even around little things. And so that's important for, you know, making a world, you know, feel lived in, right? Like, I'm reading this really interesting book at the moment called Why Men Barbecue. It's a series of sort of, I guess it's a bit more on the sociology end of social psychology. And it's about how these, like, sort of seemingly, like, very universal or very simple customs are actually, like, super different across cultures. Like, there's one chapter about how who shares a bed with who, or who shares a sleeping room with who, is very different across cultures. Like, the model that we have in, like, the US and the UK, where, like, kids from a very young age do not sleep in the same room as their parents, is actually globally much more rare.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of thing that's, like, interesting to keep in mind in a fantasy world, right? If your characters are traveling through different places, or if they come from different cultures than each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Have you got any tips then for writers who are maybe interested in learning more about psychology and political psychology?
Yeah. So I would recommend reading some psychology books that are sort of more accessible. I'll recommend, like, the two sort of, like, most readable social psychology books I can recommend are B.F. Skinner's Walden 2, which is actually a fiction book. And it's about essentially, like, trying to build a utopia off of behavioral psychology. And I absolutely do not agree with everything in it, but it will give you sort of an interesting insight into behavioral psychology, although perhaps where behavioral psychology was a little bit in the past. But it's still a very interesting idea of sort of, like, how people respond to stimuli and that kind of thing. It's also just a really interestingly written book, so I would recommend it. And then in terms of political psychology, I would recommend Jonathan Haidt's, and that's spelled H-A-I-D-T-S. Oh, no, wait, sorry. The S would be possessive. H-A-I-D-T his book, Righteous Minds, which is a fantastically well-written book. It's primarily focused on moral psychology and something called moral foundations theory, which he's one of the pioneers of. Basically, the idea that, like, different people have different morality, and that's one of the sort of fundamental bases of political divides. But it touches on a ton of other social psychology topics, in a very understandable way, and it's super well written. He both sides things politically a bit more than I am comfortable with. Like, I am recommending the book. I am not recommending his politics. I want to be very clear about that. He also has an epilogue where he goes into his own politics a little bit, and I find many of them very silly. But it is a fantastic book. It's also, you know, very, very well written. And it's a very good sort of intro to things. I also plug my own channel, quite frankly, because, yeah, so my channel's about political psychology. I have a bunch of different videos out. I think that one that is especially interesting is I have one coming out on the psychology of sexism, and also how sexism can exist without like hatred for women, which I think is especially useful for writers who are writing in a setting that's sort of, you know, more or differently patriarchal than our own to know. So that video should be out in a few weeks, and I definitely would recommend that to writers. I also have one on the intersection between genetics and politics, and one about sort of just what shapes our politics generally. I wish I could recommend more like political psychology creators, but this is honestly a really small niche. I'm not trying to only recommend myself. I haven't been able to really find anyone but myself. Also, what I would say is good is like, so political psychology is very complicated to do, but it's not that complicated to understand. So if there is a topic you're especially interested in, especially if you've done like an intro psych course or something at some point, you'll probably be able to understand at least the abstract of an article about it. So, you know, just look things up, right?
Yeah,
like, because the academic literature isn't completely inaccessible. Like, there's jargon, but you can look those things up. I do also take suggestions on my YouTube channel. So if there's any topic that's like really stumping you, head over there and ask me.
So what is, it's Political Psych with Abby is the name of your channel, is it?
Yep. And you can also find me on Reddit and Instagram. Yeah, I think that's, and I also have a Discord account, but I prefer if you people contact me via Reddit or Instagram instead of Discord. But if that's the only one you've got, just comment in a YouTube video.
Fantastic. Abby, it's been wonderful having you on the show. I've learned so much chatting to you. And I hope everyone out there listening has learned something new as well. We are going to be looking more at psychology, sociology, physiology, these key elements of creating characters in the next few episodes. So to kick things off with psychology, and especially a look at political psychology, which is just filled with conflict, it's been fantastic. So thank you very much, Abby.
Thanks, Aya. I hope I still made sense.
Thanks very much, Abby. And we'll speak to everyone soon. A big thank you again to Abby for fighting off COVID to chat about psychology. I hope you've learned something new. It can be a bit intimidating, psychology, and that's why I think it's really good to get specialists and experts and who can really explain things in accessible ways and understandable ways, because that's how we learn. We need a foundational understanding of things before we go on and get a little bit more technical. And like I said, I hope you've learned something new about creating characters, what makes people tick, what motivates people. To be honest, we've only just really scratched the surface with psychology, and Abby will kindly be returning in the next few episodes to expand upon what we discussed today. Got some calls for submissions now, and there are a few really interesting ones. First up, Proton Reader, which is a new market, pays 8 cents a word for the first 2,000 words and then 2 cents a word afterwards. The intention is apparently to increase the pay rate in the future. And they're looking for stories between 250 and 15,000 words. So if you've got one of them expansive short stories, then give them a go. They're open for first issue submissions as well, so it'll be nice to get in there in the first edition. So go to protonreader.com to learn more about that. Next up, Knight Writing Press, which is Knight with an K, as in former warrior class. And they're looking for subs for its anthology, Mare Maiden, which is a collection of tales about the trouble of having a tail. 7,000 word cap for this one. The payment is a royalty split. So if you have any mermaid related sales, why not head over to nightwritingpress.com/mermaidens, which is MERMAIDENS. You can learn a bit more there. Next, Flashpoint SF is open for general submissions. They're a flash fiction market and they accept all kinds of fantasy and science fiction, despite the name. And the payment is $15 and they're looking for stories between 100 and 1,000 words. Head to flashpointssf.com to learn more. And lastly, Radon Journal. This is a magazine that has a political focus and they pay 1 cent a word for original stories and half a cent for reprints. And there is a 3,000-word limit for submissions on that one. Head to radonjournal.com for more. Good luck, as always. And if you do find success, please email in and let me know. I always love to hear if someone got a successful outcome with short stories. So, yeah, please do share your news. Just write in at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com. Now I've got a couple of bits of news for you now. One good, one not so good. I'm going to start with the bad news first, get that one out the way. But I do believe this only really applies to people in the UK at the moment, though it may be a sign of things to come for the rest of the world. Now, it was reported this week in The Bookseller that the cost of printing books is going to rise by as much as 40%. The Bookseller reported that independent publishers are becoming increasingly worried by these massive hikes, and some now are looking to outsource to countries in Europe and maybe China to keep prices down. The issue with an increase in costs is fear that obviously profit margins are going to massively decrease. Are you going to pass that cost on to the consumer, or do you try and absorb it? That is the big fear, and many small presses are concerned about closing down now. The reason for this massive increase is all down to supplier costs surging. So raw materials and apparently problems to do with Brexit in the UK have contributed to this as well. And also fuel and freight costs have gone right up too. So it's not looking good. There's a variety of reasons which are contributing to this. I mean, costs are going up across the board beyond writing everything. I mean, MailChimp, the cost of that's gone up, even though they've just been taken over for billions. And our energy costs are going up, petrol costs are going up, everything's getting more expensive. And as writers, we get paid very little anyway. So yeah, not looking good. But on a more positive note, it was also reported in The Bookseller again that film studios and networks like Netflix and Amazon are scouring the world for books to adapt into films and TV shows. According to The Bookseller, more books are currently being optioned than ever before due to the likes of streaming services like Netflix. Netflix apparently has told The Bookseller that the chance of a book being adapted at the moment has never been higher. We've seen it. Fantasy, Lords of the Rings, The new TV series, apparently they've spent $1 billion on it, and that's due out in September. The Wheel of Time, The Witcher, Shadow and Bone. Loads and loads of books are getting turned into series and films. So if you've got an agent, I'd be getting right onto them and saying, get this book out into a few production companies. Because at the end of the day, even if your book gets optioned, you still get paid for that as an author. And I know some really successful fantasy authors who've written some amazing books. Adrian Tchaikovsky, for example, was telling me at FantasyCon how he had a book optioned for years. And just because a book gets optioned, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to get made into a film. It's just that production company holds the rights to turn it into a film. So you can make a living off that. So yeah, by all means, get your books out there, especially if printing costs are going up. So we've got to think of ways to do things a bit differently, haven't we? So yeah, that's all for the news. If you come across anything interesting yourself that you think other people would appreciate, please drop me an email with the link and I'll check it out. Now I want to turn to a writing tip and in particular, how to create suspense with our writing. I've got a detailed guide on this, which you can find a link to in the description. And I just wanted to share some key points from this guide, particularly one device or writing tool, which is really simple. You'll be amazed how simple this is. You might already even be doing it. And it's a great way to create suspense and keep readers hooked. And if you ever wondered what suspense actually is, it's basically the reason behind why readers complain about flat stories or that the book never grabbed them. And what is often the missing ingredient in these situations is suspense, glue that binds the reader's hands to the covers. And if we just take a look at what the definition of suspense is, it is literally a state or a feeling of excited or anxious uncertainty about what might happen. And that is essentially what we're trying to create in the readers. We want them to be uncertain about what's going to happen. And because of that uncertainty, they either feel excited, anxious, nervous, anything like that, really, because they're feeling something. That keeps them invested in the story. It builds the suspense. And it's vital knowing how to do this as a writer, especially when it comes to long fiction pieces like novels. And let's dive into why readers like suspense. I want to start with a quote. "The suspense is terrible. I hope it will last." Now, I remember Gene Wilder saying that in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, but it is a Oscar Wilde quote, I believe. And it sums up neatly the effect suspense has on readers. We both love and hate it. It excites us, it titillates us, yet it frays our nerves. Sometimes it causes upset, but all the same, it hooks readers. And I want to give you another quote now, which expands upon this. And this comes from master editor Sol Steen. And he summarizes the whole duty of a writer well when it comes to suspense. And that is that a writer's duty is to set up something that cries for a resolution and then to act irresponsibly, to dance away from the reader's problem, dealing with other things, prolonging and exacerbating the reader's desperate need for a resolution. That quote came from his book, Steen on Writing, which I recommend highly, a very good book. Now, one of the simplest yet most effective ways of building suspense is to use the structure of your story. And this method, this simple tool, which I've mentioned a few times so far, it's called architectural suspense. Now, architectural suspense simply involves taking your different threads of the story, the different paths, journeys that your characters are going on, and unspooling them in a way that teases the reader. Now, these threads, they may be completely independent to begin with. As the story progresses, these storylines may weave together or cross each other, but it's very much how the story is revealed that concerns us here for architectural suspense. And using these different threads, I mean, there's no limit to the amount of threads, storylines that you can have. The more you have, the more suspenseful the tale. And the issue then you have is that it's going to become more complex to tell, as George R. R. Martin can attest to. So how does this actually translate to writing? Well, quite simply, if we take two strands, we've got strand A, strand B, and we're going to start with A. And ideally, what we want to do is end that chapter on a bit of a cliffhanger, because we want the reader to want to know what happens next. That is the key. But we're not going to tell them right away. We're going to move to strand B, and that story is going to unfold. And then we're going to leave that story in a similar state as we did strand A. It's going to be uncertain. There could be great stakes involved. But next, in chapter three, we're going to return to A, and we're going to leave B alone. And by now, the reader should hopefully be wanting to know what happens to to the characters in that second chapter. But we're going to go back to the first and continue that story. And basically, it's this simple pattern of jumping from one to the next to the next. And as you introduce more threads, more perspectives, more characters, you can create more suspense. Like Game of Thrones is a fantastic example. I used to love the chapters to do with Tyrion and Jon and Arya. So what I'd do is just race through the less interesting ones, in my opinion anyway, to get to the characters that I wanted to read. And that is essentially what George R. R. Martin did. He used the structure of the story to create a really suspenseful, gripping tale. And another example we can take is from James Barclay's novel Noonshade. So chapter one, it ends with a siege at breaking point. We're left with the thoughts of a character named Barriss, who suggests he's got a few tricks up his sleeve to try and turn the tide. But of course, Barclay is too smart to tell us what they are there and then. Instead, we have to wait for chapter three. Because in chapter two, the tale follows completely different characters hundreds of miles away, doing something completely irrelevant to what happened in chapter one. It's annoying, but it does make you want to read on, especially if that second chapter is interesting. And as it happens, yeah, it does. It ends with another cliffhanger. And then we come back to chapter three and back to Barriss, who, while all the while I'm wanting to know what happens in chapter two, Barriss does something amazing. And yeah, that then ends at a bit of a cliffhanger. And you can see what I say about a cycle. This is what happens. It's an ongoing cycle in which suspense is built and we move on to start again, essentially, and tease the reader even more. Now, I want to bring back Solstein here because he provided a very handy template for creating suspense and basically to codify what we've just taken away from these examples, and that is chapter one. This chapter has to end with a turn of events that leaves the reader in suspense. The reader wants to stay with the characters and see the action that happens next. But in chapter two, the reader finds themselves in another place and or with a different character. The reader still wants to know what happens in chapter one, but chapter two hopefully is gripping, and it ends with a turn of events that leaves the reader in suspense once more. In chapter three, we return to the continuation of the suspenseful events in chapter one. The reader is hopefully still in suspense about chapter two, and by the end of chapter three, you've created a new line of suspense. And if you keep doing this with successive chapters, the reader will hopefully be continuously in suspense, and there will be no saggy middles in the book. There's going to be constant conflict, and hopefully your reader's going to absolutely love it. So that was a bit about creating suspense in stories. There are lots of other ways. That is just one particular way I find very easy to understand and very easy to implement. And it's also one of the most effective methods and tools I have come across when it comes to building suspense. Hopefully you enjoy it. If you find success, or if you've got any other methods that you'd like to share with everybody else about creating suspense, please do email in, and why not join our writing community too? The link for both are in the description. Now we've come to the end of the show. I hope you found it useful today in some way. If you did, I'd be very grateful if you could follow or subscribe us, leave us a review or a rating on Spotify, this brand new feature that they've been shouting about. And please share the show with anyone you think may be interested. Don't forget, you can expand your learning beyond this podcast via our Patreon page. And we'll be back on Valentine's Day for some medieval history with Aidan Mattis and more folklore chat. Very sexy. Thanks for listening today. Happy scribbling.